Hey marketers, if you want to get the latest news, trends, and insights in marketing, advertising, and tech, check out the Adweek Podcast Network. Learn from leading voices across media and marketing with original shows like Yeah, That's Probably an Ad, Marketing Vanguard, and Tech Magic with Kathy Hackle. Start listening now by searching Adweek wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there, are you ready to elevate your personal brand or company? Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for video content and audience building. Imagine growing your brand organically on social media without the hassle of editing videos for hours. With Viral Growth, it's a breeze. They handle the brainstorming, scripting, and editing while you simply just hit record. And don't worry about your niche. They cater to everyone, from business and marketing to health and wellness. Are you ready to make waves in the social media realm? Visit viralgrowth.io and use code ADWEEK, that's ADWEEK, all lowercase, and get 10% off your plan.
You're listening to Yeah, That's Probably an Ad, a show where we discuss trends, marketing, pop culture, and food media, because at the end of the day, everything is an ad. I am Luz Corona, Adweek Community Editor, coming to you live from the podcast studio at Commerce Week. And today we are joined by Matt Rodbard, Editor-in-Chief of Taste, an online cooking and food culture magazine. Matt, welcome.
Great to be here, Luz. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. So I'm going to ask you all about your day job, but I was kind of scrolling through your experience, and you did not originally start in this part of media.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory and how you ended up here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great question. I think I started, you know, working in television in the late 90s, early 2000s. I worked at Court TV, MTV, Fox News Channel as an intern. That's for another day, that story.
Yeah.
But and then I pivoted over to traditional print media, and I worked at some magazine startups. Worked at WWE Magazine, which was the official magazine for WWE. It's also for another day,
yeah,
that conversation. But then I found myself in food media about 14 years ago, writing for Time Out and some of like the older established publications. And I ended up working as an editor at a couple, I would call them city guides, called Metro Mix, and then Food Republic. And I started building my writing chops. And I also wrote cookbooks along the way too. So I was an editor at those publications and writing cookbooks. And eventually I made it to Taste, which I've worked at for 7 years. And I'm the founding editor-in-chief of Taste and the host of This Is Taste, which is a podcast as well. Mm-hmm. And so I've had, I've seen entertainment, I've seen the music industry, but mostly food is now my focus.
Yeah. So you started in kind of like media journalism, and then you wrote cookbooks.
Yeah.
So where was that? Was food always like a passion of yours, and you were able to mix both worlds?
It was always a passion in my personal life. Like, I always enjoyed going to restaurants. I was raised going to restaurants and being ambitious, but certainly I didn't realize food was a career path in media until I started really pivoting from print journalism into more digital spaces, working at AOL as well. I forgot to mention that. And just kind of getting a sense of the scene in New York, and getting a sense that as subjects to write about, as topics, you know, food to me excited me, but also was a rich text to actually write about an opening restaurant or a chef or even a recipe, to me was way more interesting than, like, you know, talking about Franz Ferdinand, you know, which, you know, cool band, but ultimately not as resonant with the general public.
Right.
There's like music people, there's movie people. Food people are kind of everyone.
Everyone.
We got to eat it 3 to 6 times a day, depending on how ambitious you are.
Yes, you know, we love food.
We all relate to it. It's a great thing to write about because everyone can relate.
Yeah, and it's just really like boomed over the last few years, which I want to pick your brain about. But for our listeners who may not be as familiar with Taste, can you give us a quick rundown of what Taste covers and how it's different than other food-centric editorial?
Great question, Luz. I think it's definitely unique property in that we are journalists. I mean, I am, and my colleagues there come from the world of editorial and journalism, though we sit in the marketing department at Penguin Random House. So it's a unique opportunity to both cover the world of food and grow our audience, which we have over the past 8 years. We have over 200,000 newsletter subscribers, and we have a very popular podcast. But we've also, with content marketing in a sense, For this audience at Adweek, you know, it's words that resonate. For our readers, it's not really part of what they think about, but essentially we have our, you know, 75 to 100 authors within Crown Publishing Group where I work, and then the larger world of Penguin Random House, double that, and we have them, you know, in the pages of Taste online, we have them in social, and we have them in the podcast studio talking about their new projects, talking about what books they're working on, what books they're selling, and we sell a lot of cookbooks. Mm-hmm. So that's part of our business, is the content marketing. But really what I would love to talk about is the way we do brand and partnership.
Right.
It's really unique in that we are extremely high touch. We're in that world of premium storytelling. I hate using that, but you know what I mean.
Yep.
Listeners. I feel like right now there's a real need for that in media. When you look at a website that is hosting a recipe or hosting an interview with a chef, and you look at it and it's filled with, littered with ads in the worst possible way, the ad tech is poor. And really, the baseline is low for most consumers who are going to look for a recipe or find out about a new chef. It's really challenging. And I don't mean to point fingers at the Dot Dashes of the world, the Condés of the world, because I have friends who work at all those brands and I have written for all those publications. But for us at Taste, you know, we really are very light touch with the way we bring our brands in to our content. And it's really been quite effective.
Right. Right. Now, talk to me a little bit about this light touch approach. Like, what does that mean? Like, just not in your face advertising? Like, how, what's the approach?
It's great. I'm glad. Very smart follow-up question, because I feel I said something that was very specific and light touch or could go in a lot of directions, I'll say.
Yeah.
And like, light touch means this. It means we are not overselling the brand in an overt way to our audience. Mm-hmm. But for example, we worked with Hormel on a really interesting branded podcast. And we talked about Spam, which is, you know, to many, it's one thing, which is a low cost food that maybe is lower nutritional value and just like not really what they want to eat for some communities. But for other communities, including Korean American population, we had Esther Choi on as the guest and talked about her relationship with Spam. We were able to dive into real traditional cooking. And in the Korean culture, Spam is heralded. It's an essential food item for many people. So we were able to have this very rich conversation and also bring the brand into our many spaces. So obviously on the podcast, but in our newsletter, which has over 200,000 subscribers, in our social feed, and eventually we may do an offline event with them. We've talked about that lightly with them. So for us, it all feels very quote unquote native.
Yeah.
The touch is light. It's not just throwing up SponCon content. We really think it through, but Our partners have really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and they understand that, I'm assuming. I mean, you don't want to exhaust the user on the site, then that's not good for either of the partners.
Lucy, it's like our real benefit. As I said, you know, we're not only ad-backed. We have like real KPIs that are tied to marketing of our cookbooks. So that's really part of it. But so we don't have to, you know, quote-unquote, have X amount of clients each year. So we're very selective.
Okay,
we find excuse me. We find the right partner and we execute a program that we feel is best suited for our audience. And for us, though, we love dreaming up ideas. It's my colleague Peter Romero, who's head of brand partnerships, and myself, we talk daily about dreaming up ideas for our partners. And to be honest, it's a great challenge for us as an editorial operation versus, you know, doing the average standard tricks, which is banner ads, right, which is pre-roll. All that stuff is fine, and we do it, you know, from time to time, though no banner ads on our website. We still want to actually push the limits a little bit. Do you buy that at all? I'm wondering,
Luz,
I feel you've heard like literally everyone come in and say that stuff. Like, I'm into premium storytelling, and you've heard it from everyone. So do you buy it, though?
Yes, I do. I do, because you know what? I went on your site, and I actually got that vibe. Like, it's not littered with the programmatic ads or anything, and I was just so curious. Also, you get to the site, and you're scrolling, and the visuals are stunning. There's
kind of
an air of sophistication. Yeah. So I'm curious, like, this isn't your average foodie site, I feel. Like, there's a certain, like, what does your audience look like?
Really good question. And thank you for checking out the site. You know, we are not where you're going to necessarily find the three dishes you're going to cook that week. You know, that's not what we do. Many people do that really well.
Right.
Smitten Kitchen, for example, amazing, amazing site that has lots of recipes. And we have lots of recipes ourselves, but to your point, it's more magazine style editorial. It's pure editorial. We're writing about everything from the return of the terrine, which you wrote about this week. You wrote about apples and all the different varieties that we're seeing around the world, really, and how we think there's a real boom in like this apple movement, to like, you know, stories about cocktails. We've like started writing a little bit about liquor, and honestly, cocktails to me is interesting. And
I saw a controversial take on a cocktail on your site.
Espresso martini. We're gonna talk about it. What do you you're still into it, right?
It started with espresso martini is dead, and then it was, and then it said the cocktail that, you know, the writer was writing about, and it did intrigue me, and I did click on it, and I don't agree with the hot take, but it was interesting, the framing.
Calling me out for the cheap tricks.
I'm like, lies.
The cheap clickbait that we use.
No, but it makes sense. I love it. That's what the conversation is right now, and that's what you guys cover.
We do, and we definitely want to think about the culture of food. When I launched Taste 8 years ago, it was all about the culture of food. And certainly, diversity and inclusion has been embedded in our content since 2016. Like, it predates a major movement in food media that was much needed. And I'm very proud of the way that our industry has changed. I'm also very proud of the way Taste certainly was not even ahead of the curve. We were just doing what instinctually we felt was right, which is writing about the world we live in, which is not from necessarily a white, straight, cis male point of view. The celebrity chef of the early 2000s, if you look on the cover of Time magazine, was basically those types of guys. We think food came from a swath of communities. It is no monolith. And we were celebrating that back then, and we continue to celebrate it today. So it's very natural for us to write about the diversity of food.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's how people connect to their cultures, too, and everything.
Hey there, podcast fam. Are you ready to break free from the social media rut? Hold on to your hatch, because we've got just the thing for you. Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for leveling up your online presence. Whether you're a personal brand or a company, they've got the tools and know-how to take you to the next level. With Viral Growth, forget about those endless hours of video editing. They handle everything from brainstorming to polishing your content, so you can just focus on being awesome. And guess what? We're hooking you up with a sweet deal. Use code ADWEEK for 10% off when you sign up. Ready to take your social media game to the next level? Head on over to viralgrowth.io and let's turn those digital dreams into a reality.
Now, you just talked about this, Matt. Food content has really gone through so many stages in the past few years. I mean, I was trying to think back. I remember Tasty. Yeah. That was like huge. Yeah. Pandemic, recipe videos now on social media, on all our feeds. So what has been the most surprising part about the evolution of food retail?
Great question. I mean, food has in media has changed so dramatically. It used to be all about like clicky, click, click, right? Clicking on recipes. And really, that was how folks made their money. Like, Epi was making like 14 or 15 million uniques a month. And it was like a gravy train for them, pun intended. But now, with obviously the shift to social, in a meaningful way, you know, shift to social has always been a thing, or pivot to video has always been a thing. But with food, we knew during the pandemic, we witnessed it firsthand. TikTok is where people were learning about food, we're learning about restaurants, we're learning about home cooking.
Right.
And I think some of the bigger publishers were caught certainly flat-footed with this drastic change. And you know what? I'm going to say this. It's not fully done. Like, I don't think major publishers are like dead in the water and TikTok is the future. I think that platform in particular, and we can also talk about Twitch and YouTube. We can also talk about Instagram and anything with Meta. But I think we're talking about TikTok. It's not great anymore.
Right.
It's not great. I think that that's a real general consensus about food creators on TikTok are struggling. Many are moving to other platforms like YouTube. But TikTok is not great, and I don't know if it resonates and stays. Certainly it was fun when during the pandemic to find somebody cooking their grandmother's dishes, like a ajumma from Korea or a grandmother from Mexico. Certainly all that kind of like that real spiritual home cooking, like I'm learning recipes, that was great during the pandemic. But I don't know if it sticks with you. I don't know if it sticks to your bones.
Yep.
And I think right now, as a publisher of cookbooks, we are really tapped in at Taste and at Penguin Random House because we have such a diversity of authors. We have very traditional, like Ina Garten, like she's been around for a while. She's like one of our favorite authors and still does extremely well. And we love Ina's books. We have also like Alison Roman and Molly Baz, but we also have Priya Krishna, and we have books from TikTokers.
Right.
And you know what? The actual response has been kind of mixed, some of the TikTokers. And, you know, we published many great ones. But honestly, it's very challenging to market a book from a only TikToker right now. So that's a little bit of a roundabout question, I think, to answer, like, what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's so interesting to hear, because TikTok is just, like, such a go-to for... It's a platform of discovery and everything, but it's interesting to see that you see kind of like a shift happening. Now, obviously, you know, our audience is comprised of marketers, and that's who's listening right now. So you, as per the title of your session, grocery store is content. Content is king. So what are some of the fundamentals about this like corner of the world that marketers who work on these CPG and food and beverage brands, what do they need to keep in mind? You touched on it a little bit before with kind of like food media being a little bit in jeopardy. And what can marketers do? How can they stay ahead of these rapidly evolving trends?
It's a great question, Luz. Thank you for bringing that up and surfacing it. It was a part of our talk. Me and Emily Sundberg, we had a great time. I hope you can link to that video. It was just a really fun time.
For sure.
To be on stage and actually like smack talk retail media. Yeah, that was like the funnest part about it. It's like we got the mic that retail media people, you're killing food media.
Real talk.
I mean, speaking directly to an agency or CPG, even a founder or somebody representing CPG, I go back to thinking about the story of your brand. And I think there's more to be said about the story, about the founders, and about the way the brand affects cooking and habit than necessarily like the taste test element, which happens a lot in media. I think you like, is X better than Y? Is Y better than Z? I think that like places like The Strategist and Wirecutter do a really good job at doing that. But that's only like part of the way food media covers CPG. And to me, it's not, I mean, the founder story is important, but it's like, how do you interact with a brand? Like, how is Fishwife interacting with people? Or how are we covering, how are we thinking about a brand or a category? Like, you know, better, like cult, like yogurt to me is interesting. Like, how is yogurt changing right now? How is are we moving away from coconut yogurts, these dairy-free yogurts, into more dairy yogurts?
Right.
That's just like one that comes off the dome. But I think honestly, it's not necessarily founder journey, which I think is a little bit of a played out mentality for media, but it's also not taste test. So it's somewhere like this, like spiritual, it's a category centric coverage is something that we think about a lot. The 30,000 foot view story is what we think about a lot.
Gotcha. And that's so fascinating. And that leads me to my next and final question, actually, because I really want to pick your brain. Where do you see the future of food retail and content? So maybe let's talk about like this year, kind of where you see it going, and where do you see it going in 5 years, pending there's no pandemic or any other major shift? But right now, where do you see like the food retail?
Food retail and media right now is at a crossroads. So will money sustain major publishers like Dot Dash, Condé Nast, et cetera. So that's like the key. Like, are we going to have Bon Appetit in 5 years? I don't know.
Right.
I have no idea if Bon Appetit will be around. So, you know, media marketers are going to have to decide how do you work with media? How do you actually engage with the audiences that they still have? Because platforms will certainly be one place where you can connect with your consumer. Obviously, retail media, so working with retailers is another way you can connect with your consumers. But there's still a place for traditional media covering your products. So I do think it's a little bit more, I would say, like, back to my point about curated and more custom, I think custom publishing with retail is, or like CPG is going to be interesting. And we'll see more creative avenues. I think we'll see email continue to grow. I think that's going to be important. But also, just the general coverage of grocery is going to go more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I call out, you know, Andrea Hernandez from Snackshot. I call it Nia Rosen. I call it some of these great, you know, Substack internet email-based journalists, I would call them. I mean, Andrea might buck that term, but she is a journalist in many ways. And I think I give them a lot of credit for starting this movement. Emily Sundberg from Feed Me, who joined the stage with me, all these individuals think about the grocery store and think about the convenience store and think about it as something to cover that's not in that trade world. That's not just talking about the transaction nature. It's actually talking about the spiritual nature. It's about talking about, like, how are these brands marketing and, like, calling out brands that maybe aren't marketing well and thinking about the way retailers are merchandising in the store. I mean, the grocery store is such a rich text. I love going in there to any type. It could be Walmart. It could be ShopRite. But it also could be Pop-Up Grocer or Foxtrot. And I look at these brands. Each of these brands has a really interesting story. And I think as a food writer, we forgot about that or we ignored that. We were so obsessed with, like, the recipe. I think my headline is that the recipe might be quite dead in some ways, okay, at least online. Shots fired, I guess. But
full of controversial takes today. I love it.
The recipe might be dead. And cookbooks, and I think it's a place where we are going to succeed, is like you go to a cookbook for a recipe or a collection of 65 to 150 recipes, but like finding recipes online. I mean, the New York Times has won.
Right.
They've won that arms race. Like, right. Everyone, I mean, that's an amazing product that they've done there. The rest of the recipe-centric platforms and the recipe-centric websites are probably going to be sunset. So they're going to have to figure out something else to do. And I think one thing they're going to do is maybe cover the grocery store in a more creative way, the way Andrea has really been a real, I think, pioneer in the way that she's brought a lot of life and energy to covering grocery store.
Yeah, she's got a huge following.
So yeah, you follow her?
Yeah. So it just goes to show, like, people are interested in this kind of content, taking it next level.
Definitely.
Now I always do this, but I'm gonna look extra close at, like, the food setup and everything in the supermarket, because it's all, at the end of the day, everything is an ad.
It's a $1 trillion business too. So talking about, let's put some money behind the grocery store. The grocery industry is $1 trillion.
Right.
So that's real. Like, that's an embellishment. That's a real fact. So you think about how big this business is and how little it's covered in mainstream media.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the key, because everything is an ad when you go to the grocery store.
Yes. Yeah. All the brand names and everything. Matt, this has been fascinating. I can't wait to see what happens the next year. And thank you so much for joining.
Luce, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Yeah, That's Probably an Ad, part of the Adweek Podcast Network and Acast Creator Network. This podcast was produced by me, Al Manarino, executive produced by Chris Ahrens and John Heil, and edited by Lane McGivney at Boutwell Studios. You can listen and subscribe to all of Adweek's podcasts by visiting adweek.com/podcasts. Stay updated on all things Adweek Podcast Network by following us on Twitter at Adweek Podcast. And if you have a question or suggestion for the show, send us an email at podcast@adweek.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, are you ready to elevate your personal brand or company? Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for video content and audience building. Imagine growing your brand organically on social media without the hassle of editing videos for hours. With Viral Growth, it's a breeze. They handle the brainstorming, scripting, and editing while you simply just hit record. And don't worry about your niche. They cater to everyone, from business and marketing to health and wellness. Are you ready to make waves in the social media realm? Visit viralgrowth.io and use code ADWEEK, that's ADWEEK, all lowercase, and get 10% off your plan.